FM, K282BH, Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR, Hood River on 91.9 FM.
At KBOO, we're always busy bees preparing wonderful programming for you to enjoy. Now, during our spring membership drive, we need some money to go with that honey. Help us raise $56,000 by May 28th to support our efforts to pollinate the media landscape with locally produced, independent, people-powered community radio. Donate right now at kboo.fm/give or tap the donate button in the KBOO mobile app.
Jeremiah Wright Jr., you're tuned in to Hard Rock Radio.
No, Hard Knock. Just say this hard is yeah, Hard Knock. Yeah, so you just got to say this is Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
This is Reverend
and Jeremiah Wright, and you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yo. This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. You're tuned in to Hard Knock. Yo, keep it real, right? You know what I'm
Wait, one more time, because they're not gonna believe it was you.
This is Reverend Jeremiah Wright Jr. And you're tuned in to Hard Knock. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for your support. God bless you.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to continue the conversations that we started last week around the changing media landscape. Of course, what has sparked this discussion has been Elon Musk, who we know as a tech, I'll put quotations around the word guru. but, you know, we associate him because of his ownership of Tesla, the electric vehicles. But he's also been very outspoken. He's been eccentric. He's been controversial. He's definitely been one to challenge the current norms around, broadcasting and speech online. And he's been annoyed with Twitter for quite a while. He felt that Twitter was censoring a lot of people. Many of the people that were being censored had very controversial points of view or views that many would label hate speech. And so Elon Musk decided that he could pony up $44 billion and he's bought it. That has sent shockwaves all around the world, and we've been having a number of discussions about what does that mean? What does the notion of free speech mean? What does it mean when a major communication apparatus is completely private? And so we wanted to talk to Steve Renderos, who heads up the Center for Media Justice. So welcome to the show, Steve. And yes. I guess, you know, when we talk about just fighting for media justice, the introduction of Elon Musk is just a continuation of a long history of battles that we've had in this sphere. So let's start off with how you're seeing things and where does Elon Musk land in this discussion from the standpoint of Center for Media Justice.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you for having me. I mean, first off, it is a continuation of history. I mean, I think powerful people with big moneyed interests have always had significant influence over the means of communications of our time. You can take this as far back as like the era of yellow journalism, with, you know, William Randolph Hearst, and you know, bring it forward to where corporations started having major influence over, you know, what content made it into and didn't make it into a newspaper, like, you know, in the era of the 60s, where the tobacco industry, being the largest advertiser, very much dictated that a lot of newspapers would not cover its effects on people's health, you know, because of their buying power on a lot of newspapers. So, you know, so we take it to today. I think it's not surprising to see the possibility of, you know, one of the 10 richest people in the world buy up a major platform of communications. You know, there's already another one that's owned by a different billionaire that's in that top 10 list, Mark Zuckerberg. But I think that part of what, to me, makes it slightly different in this current context is that the internet has enabled an opportunity for decentralized speech, you know, for more and more people to dictate and elevate and amplify their stories. And that makes, you know, the moment right now of Twitter, you know, being sold by its shareholders and transitioning into a privately held company, you know, dominated by Elon Musk, who won't be accountable to any shareholders, which makes it only slightly, you know, only slightly worse than what the current situation is with Twitter and with Facebook and all these other companies. But taking these, you know, platforms that have become critical avenues for discourse, you know, taking that away from shareholders and into private ownership and into the hands of someone who, even though he calls himself a free speech absolutist, is a contradiction in that way. He doesn't care about free speech. He cares about his speech. And he has demonstrated his ability to go after people who are critical of him, using the very tool that he's purchasing right now, Twitter. So it's concerning, but I also think it's an opportunity for us to be thinking about what the future of this infrastructure that we call the internet really should be in our lives, and where we choose to spend our time and to you know, continue populating you know, our discussions. I think the sites of these things have to change, and I think there's some interesting ways that people are talking about already doing that.
There's a couple of questions that come to mind. Steve Renderos is our guest, heads up the Center for Media Justice. Let's start off with the first question. I'm gonna put both questions out, and we'll take them one at a time. One question that comes to mind is, what have we been doing, you know, over the past 20 years with the introduction of, you know, social media? We can go all the way back to the days of MySpace, all the way up. And I'm asking, when I say, what have we been doing? A lot of people became very dependent upon these things, and we were on a path before these social media platforms came into being to really establishing our own respective brands. There was a Center for Media Justice website. There was a DVD website. There's a KPFA or Pacifica website. We can go on and on. And those sites were part of this decentralizing aspect that you talked about, or democratizing aspect, in the sense that we had to be skilled. We had to dedicate some time to making our respective digital homes attractive. We had to populate it with content, and we had to build community. And we allowed a middle entity, these social media platforms, to come in, be a really disruptive force to that trajectory. And all of a sudden, a lot of our blood and sweat equity and creativity went into these apparatuses, which, as our last guest, when we talked about this last week, Andreas Jackson, he said, we can just turn off the switch anytime. And so this leads to the other question, and we'll start off with this last question first. Center for Media Justice, along with, you know, what is Rashad Robinson's organization?
Color of Change.
Color of Change.
Yeah.
You all have been battling these social media platforms for quite some time because of arbitrary censorship from Facebook to Twitter to any other number of things that have just come along to decide, oh, I don't like trans people. They don't use their quote unquote real name. Let's censor them. We don't like the political speech that are coming from Black folks when they're talking about the police. Let's censor them. Let's talk about the history of contention that you and others have had to face with these social media platforms. And not to be long-winded, I'll end it with here. Many people are upset with Elon Musk, as if Twitter and Facebook and these other outlets had already been fair and giving and, right. you know, and really beneficial for the likes of marginalized communities.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's my entry point to fighting these companies was back in 2016 with the murder of Corin Gaines. Happened in August of 2016. She was a Black woman killed by the Baltimore County Police Department. She had been doing what I think a lot of Black folks do when there is a confrontation with police, and that's filming it, you know. And she was trying to use the tools of our time to not just film it, but also get that information out. And so she was live streaming via Instagram. And the Baltimore County Police, at the request, requested to Facebook that they take down her Instagram account and her Facebook account, which she had been using to also post updates. And then shortly after that, you know, entered her home and shot and killed her.
Remember, you know, that because the last thing we saw was an image of a cop with a helmet walking into her house, and then the feed was cut.
Yep.
And then she died. And then we had to go by their story versus what we were actually witnessing.
Exactly. You know, and that's certainly history repeating itself. You know, I think that was a moment for me where I realized that these platforms are not just these kinds of, you know, these kinds of spaces of social interaction. You know, I joined Facebook in 2005, I think. I was still just shortly out of college. It was back when it was still the Facebook. But realizing that was the real potential for harm, you know, started doing work to try to change it. You know, I will say that I think that part of why we focused so much on pressuring the companies directly was in part like a strategic choice that we made given the political conditions at the time. You know, this was Trump getting elected into office, you know, the US Congress being deeply fractured and divided. And polarized, and you know, the opportunity for policy interventions that could address some of the issues at the platform level were just not real at that time. And so the focus was like, let's try to go after the companies to try to push for some sort of harm reduction. You know, and I think once you started going down the rabbit hole of like the issues within these platforms, you get into, you know, issues of, like you were saying, people, you know, being banned, their accounts taken down, their content being taken down, primarily from marginalized voices, you know, Black folks, queer and trans folks, indigenous folks who had names that, according to Facebook, didn't sound real, things like that. So, you know, and I think we did what we could to try to make the platform, you know, less messed up for people. But in reality, I think what we found time and time again in working directly with these companies is that, you know, you could make some sort of progress, but at the end of the day, the companies were structured in the way that they were. Mark Zuckerberg still had overwhelming power to veto anything that its platform instituted as policy, you know, and that happened with Trump's like tweet of when the looting starts, the shooting starts, clearly violated a policy that Facebook had put in place around incitements to violence, and they chose in that moment, or he chose in that moment, not to apply it. So it shows the fragility of the possibility for change on these platforms because of how they're structured. They are companies, you know, and it, in most cases, and it will be in Twitter's case under Elon Musk, one individual can make a choice about what, you know, what he likes. And I use he very intentionally because it tends to be men who are running these companies, white men in particular. So I think there's limitations to what's possible for change, you know, at these companies, and that's what we learned. But I will say this, like, you know, after January 6th, you know, we mobilized again to pressure these platforms to do something about Trump, a request of taking down his account and or banning it, that we've been asking for quite some time leading up to the 2020 elections. And, you know, they, of course, didn't do that back then. We asked for them to ban Trump when he, you know, when his tweet and post when the looting starts, the shooting starts came out, and they wouldn't do that. And that was during the George Floyd protest.
But we also need to keep in mind that while his tweets that called for violence, and that wasn't the first time.
For sure.
Because he had used his Twitter account to call for violence when he was campaigning and people were coming up. And so it was a constant thing. And that's in addition to disparaging remarks that, you know, that was argued was free speech. And you started to hear the slogan, hate speech is free speech, right? Mm-hmm. So, but the problem was that to this day, you know, and I think anybody who's Black knows that to avoid using the word white, for example, if you're on Facebook mm-hmm, right. and to a certain degree yeah. Twitter, you just don't use it because all of a sudden you're flagged, right? So people yeah. have to go through all sort of contortions. If you have political things to say, you know, there's a lot of, euphemisms that you have to use. So you can just not say, you know, say Black and brown people are going to go protest, you know, white supremacy, you know, sure, it might get through, but then somebody, you know, a lot of times it gets taken down. Yep. And then you're arguing and you're debating.
Yep.
So it seems like the more conversations that Center of Media for Justice, Color of Change, and all these other organizations had directly and indirectly with these platforms, the worse it got. I didn't see any improvement, to be honest. Yeah. You know, they seem to go overboard and would even pick particular people and almost isolate them and make them feel like they were crazy, because, you know, their suspensions would be 3 days, mm-hmm. a week. Right. There are many people who are activists whose accounts are suspended for 30 days at a time. And this is after you guys were having sensitivity meetings and going down to the campuses and,
yep.
you know, doing photo ops. So what gives on this? It seems like there's a hostility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's ultimately, you know, none of those changes focused on changing the business model. And I think that's, you know, our realization a couple years into trying to do that insider work, to do the harm reduction work, to make these platforms better, and realizing that the problems only got worse. You know, we stepped away from it eventually. We don't engage directly with the companies. The last time we did was around the insurrection and working, you know, and challenging Twitter's staff to ban Trump's account, which they did, you know, and to their credit.
But did they do it for Center Media Justice, or just because you had outrage coming from all sectors, including Congress at this sure. point, who had been pretty silent up yeah. to that point?
Yeah, but you know, I think that kind of change does require some level of like a steady drumbeat of pressure.
Okay.
And I think that's something that we had held that corner with them. And I'll say this, like a week after Trump was banned, misinformation around the election dropped by like 73% on Twitter. You know, so it did have an effect, at least in the interim. But of course, like it didn't fundamentally alter the structure of how these companies function, because it didn't alter their economic model. And that's a lot of where we've been focusing our attention lately, is, you know, what are the structural interventions through legislation that can really compel a different kind of business model? Because short of that, you know, these platforms will always be outrage machines, because that's what they're designed to do. You know, it drives up engagement, and it drives up, you know, their advertising dollars, and it drives up value for their shareholders.
Steve, let me ask you this. Is this really about people saying hateful things on a platform like Twitter? Or if you can put on your Center for Media Justice hat above and beyond social mm-hmm. media platforms, I always felt the big problem was that if Trump said, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, every news agency, news agencies and media outlets that you all have been battling with for decades, you know, would pick it up. So Fox would pick it up, ABC would pick it up. The local TV stations here would give it validity. And what they wouldn't give validity would be the counter argument. If you all had a press conference and say, this is harmful, et cetera, that wouldn't be covered, but the sensationalism of an outrageous statement would be covered. So there's this ecosystem that a lot of people were built around sensationalistic comments that would come out of Trump and others who had high visibility that would then be amplified by traditional media outlets and given a certain amount of validity, because oftentimes it wasn't even critiqued. It was just put out there and said, this is what he said. How do we contextualize that and look at this larger thing? Is it really about Twitter, or is it about maybe the laziness of journalists in traditional spaces that just go to Twitter to look for their stories, find something sensational, and then amplify it to the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think both the big tech and big media have followed similar trajectories on a different timeline, but similar trajectories of major consolidation. I mean, I think going back to one of the initial questions you posed around this, like, what have we been doing? The thing is, like, you know, in the early days of the internet, there were a lot of decentralized companies, platforms, you know, apps, websites that were catering to the users themselves. And part of what happened is, much like with big media, the dominant players, the Facebooks of the world, the Apples, the Googles, started buying up their competition. They didn't innovate to make better versions of what they were doing. They instead went out and bought other people that were doing similar things, and if not better, you know. And that's where WhatsApp gets bought up by Facebook, and so does Instagram. So the ecosystem changed because these companies were allowed to buy up, you know, larger and larger swaths of the internet. And that's what happened with big media. And when we saw that happened, you know, leading into the wave of deregulation in the 80s under Reagan, and into the 90s, where, you know, with the Telecom Act that ushered in a wave of, you know, an even more higher levels of media concentration after the 96 Telecommunications Act. You know, what happened is these ecosystems were structured in such a way in which, like, they were prioritizing the content that drew eyeballs to, mm-hmm. to their stations, you know, and that's where you get the moniker of if it bleeds, it leads. And certainly I think in today's ecosystem, there is a relationship between the outrage machine that emerges on social media platforms and, you know, the cultivation of moments and content for larger media platforms, and to fill their desire for, you know, a 24/7 news cycle. So everything is, you know, everything is a moment. And I see this especially in sports journalism, where, like, the most innocuous tweet becomes like the big storyline leading up to the game.
Right.
You know, there is this kind of relationship between the two for sure.
So this comes back to the other question. What have we been doing? I think you alluded to it, that some people have started to build a better mousetrap and it would get quickly brought up, mm-hmm. you know? And I've seen that. People are like, hey, I got a new photo app. And it went from trying to be a big player to, let me see if I can make enough noise so I can get $1 billion from a Mark Zuckerberg or, right. you know, or Tim Cook or whoever was, you know, in the market to buy. So have we, as a community of Black folks, of Brown folks, as Indigenous folks, did we drop the ball in terms of saying, no matter what, we just need to have our own Twitter?
Right. Yeah.
And then let me kind of contextualize this a little bit. So there were large numbers of panel discussions. There's been meetings. I mean, there's been all these discussions all the way up to the Congressional Black Caucus about the proficiency, the innovativeness, and the strong presence of this thing we call Black Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, and questions were raised then. Okay, so you got Black Twitter. What's your stake in actual Twitter? You know, do you sit at a table for policy? Do they come to somebody who they consider Black Twitter to say, what do you all think? What's best practices? It's still a strong presence. I mean, it drives a lot of protests. It brings awareness to social justice issues. You know, all these different things, from Bill Cosby to R. Kelly, you know, those things really, you know, Trayvon Martin, all that emanates off this thing called Black Twitter.
Right.
But Black folks don't really have a stake in Twitter at all. And so now you have Elon Musk, who actually doesn't like Black Twitter, who could turn that off starting tomorrow. Yeah. And 20, you know, 15 years of social and political capital can be gone just like that. So the question is, why didn't we have our own Twitter?
Yeah. I think in part because I think we confuse choice with governance. The ability to tell your story, right? That felt like such a novel idea, or at least a novel opportunity, given the longer history of media platforms that had largely been inaccessible to people. You know, and so here comes the internet and says, say whatever you want. And I think we've mistaken that choice as governance. At the end of the day, we were joining platforms that were still governed by companies and who had very specific profit-driven interests that they were trying to drive. And certainly, I think Black folks have, you know, have played a major role in creating the value that exists today on the internet. Media Justice, we did a series on that we called This Is That's So Black, that kind of retells that history of Black folks contributing to internet culture and how it's been commodified. But I think we've mistaken that illusion of choice as something that leads to governance. And I think this leads me to where we need to be going next, which is we can't actually just join a platform because it's the place to be, you know, much like when people drove all the way over to Clubhouse to make that a thing for the summer that it was a thing. I think today we're living in a world in which, like, yes, Twitter has over 300 million users, Facebook has over 2 billion users, you know, more followers than Christianity. And I think the choice about where we go next has to be tied to our ability to be in spaces where we have more control, where we actually have the ability to govern. And, you know, and there's platforms that are trying to cater to that. There's platforms like Mastodon. There's a platform out in the Netherlands that's called PubHubs that is designed to be privacy preserving, and it's not surveillance by default, and actually gives its users way more control. You know, I think that's one piece of the solution here of where we go next. And I think that's a mistake that we made in the early days of the internet, is that false illusion of choice.
So does an organization like the Center of Media Justice, do you all, having seen this and know that, do you spark off a division within the organization? Or Color of Change that had spinoff groups, you know, as well, and say one of the goals that we will have is we will build a dedicated, unapologetic, you know, uncompromised social media platform for our people. Even if it got two users, there's going to come a day like today when Elon Musk goes, "I'm coming on," you know.
Yeah.
That we go to this, or do you all, you know, that have been in this space and fighting this good fight, do you all huddle up and say, you know, we're going to have an equity in this PubHub place that you just talked about, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, do we bring back Black Planet and say, let's tweak it and let's make sure it's owned? Or are there other strategies to bring attention to outlets that we can have a more fair stake in? Because this, and I'll close with this, one of the things I know that has been done over the years is to cultivate habits that you can't break. And I remember working for Time Warner in places like that, where that was like a goal, like make sure our customers develop a habit for our product, one that they can't quit, right? And so there's a dependency on social media. Many people wake up in the morning, first thing they go is to Instagram. That's Mark Zuckerberg. Many of them will go and look on tweets that, right. you know, that will be Elon Musk. News agencies do this now, right? What's going on? They're not going behind the paywalls. They're like, let me just read all this stuff online and then kind of build from there. And so do you all have to now at this point really provide those avenues where we can have a light at the end of the tunnel?
I mean, in part, yes. I think that there is going to be a need for finding different spaces that we can go towards. And, you know, and a couple of the examples that I threw out there, you know, with Mastodon and PubHubs are just versions, but there's other versions of this that are existing. I think that's one part of the solution. Now, will we build it as Media Justice? Probably not, but I think, you know, part of our network of organizations in the country, one of the key audiences that are members of our network are movement technologists. And that's certainly something I think that's been part of the discussion.
But why wouldn't you build that and bring them into the fold? You know, these movement folks.
Yeah. No, I'm saying us as an organization who, like, we don't have technologists on staff, so it would be a challenge for us to do that. But there are movement technologists that are working on that are part of our network. But I think the other part of the answer here is about what do we do with all the value that we've generated within these platforms, all the social networks that we've built up within these like big platforms, what happens mm-hmm. to that? And, you know, the thing that we're interested in pushing for and fighting for is platform interoperability, you know, which, you know, would allow for us to take the relationships, the social networks, the data that we generated at these companies and bring it with us to a different platform. It also would allow for us to not lose the value of those social networks. You know, a good example of this that has happened already in our, you know, in our lifetime is for a while, I think if you, folks who have been around long enough with the internet will remember the days where, you know, between Mac and PCs, there was almost no way to like develop a document on Microsoft Office and send it to someone who's a Mac user and for them to be able to open that document. That was a real challenge, but that was an interoperability challenge and Apple figured it out. And today I think like if you own a PC and you buy a MacBook, you can bring all of your documents over with you. Like they will work.
Something that you work with the companies to do, or is that something that becomes legislated? Do we have to go to Congress and say this is a utility? And just like when I want to use if I want to buy from AT&T and go to Sprint,
exactly.
They gotta give me my phone number, right? So yeah. is there a bill or something that you all are pushing for now to allow me to take all my data off of Twitter, that yeah. history, which by the way is oftentimes used by other publications in newspapers, either to get a lead to a story, to get some insight, or just to even quote you or me, you know, it's like all of a sudden we're looking at an article and my tweet is now a quote, you know, yeah. for somebody's, you know, publication, which they get compensated for, you know, there's no kickback to us for our public tweets. But with that being said, you know, do we have to go to Congress and say, y'all have to write some new rules because these companies are too big and that's have right. too much power?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. And I think that's where our attention is. It's not working with the companies directly because there's no incentive for them to do that. There are companies who by default are being built today, platforms where they are thinking about the future of the internet and they're thinking about interoperability as a core value of like the next design of the internet. But no, this has to be the kind of thing to deal with the big platform power that exists today. It has to be compelled. They're not going to do it themselves. I do think it's legislation, and I think it's a number of policies that I think they need to be driven, including, you know, exercising antitrust law to break up some of these companies, you know, pushing for legislation that compels interoperability. There isn't anything currently on the table that would do that, but that's one of the things that we've been working on with some of our allies and partners in our space to push for.
This would have to be a national bill and not so much a local one, right? I mean, absolutely. We had some local bills pass, like, you know, like in California, you know, you have right. to get the option for them to not follow you or track you or what have you. The problem is like if you don't say yes, then all of a sudden you don't have access to some of these websites.
Right.
You know, it becomes a very cumbersome thing. So it's like, all right, you don't have to track us. We don't need, you know, if you're not going to let us track us, you can't read this article.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So they did the workaround. But so are there any champions within the national politosphere that is in line with what you all are talking about?
I mean,
you often hear people say we need to break up big tech, but what's the follow-up to those statements?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a myriad of answers. So yes, I mean, I think there's leaders at the federal level who are championing these issues to some extent, you know, like the Elizabeth Warrens, who I know her mindset has been focused on antitrust, but is also interested in other kinds of interventions. I think you also have to look at some of the regulatory agencies and the power that they have. And we've been doing a lot of work trying to, you know, build inroads with the Federal Trade Commission, who's going to play a very significant role, I think, in the regulation of these companies. They have the ability to engage in what they call rulemaking. And you have a chair, Lina Khan, who is, you know, no fan of the big tech companies. You have a pretty progressive second commissioner, Rebecca Slaughter, who is very amenable to our perspective on these issues. And then they have a third commissioner who was nominated by Biden, who has gotten stuck in the nomination process because, you know, there are moneyed interests on the right that are preventing those nominations from going through. But Alvaro Bedoya, who's a, you know, longtime a scholar on surveillance, particularly racialized surveillance, and so he's someone that I think has the right kind of set of views on this. And
what's that name again?
Alvaro Bedoya. And you know, and I think those three being, you know, commissioners at the FTC, I think there's a lot that is potentially possible there at that regulatory agency if Alvaro's confirmation is able to go through, and that's something that we've been advocating for sure. You know, I think there are limitations at the federal level, of course. Like, you know, we're about to enter a midterm that doesn't look to be too kind to Biden's policy agenda. So, which makes these kinds of independent regulatory agencies even more important in the short term.
The FCC is off the table now because, you know, we lost that fight, that 10-year battle around net neutrality. A lot of people, again, you know, if we look at the fight around preserving net neutrality, mm-hmm. these social media outlets wound up serving as a middleman because so many people were on them. When you said, hey, you know, if we don't protect this internet, we're not going to be able to get from point A to point B. And it's like, well, I can do that on Facebook. I can do that on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Why bother with this fight? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people fell asleep at the wheel. As all of a sudden, like, my website is not as accessible as the New York Times, meaning that it used to be one click would get you to my site, one click would get you to your site, one click would get you to the New York Times, right? Now it's one click to the New York Times and 10 clicks to get to Steve Renderos and
right.
five clicks to get to Davey D because they were now able to tier the internet. And which means that in order to avoid having this tiered process, you wind up going back to social media where you actually would have a little bit more reach.
Right.
So we got trapped there. That's frustrating to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, we've been defaulting towards the places where the distribution platforms that are big and that have the audiences already built in large part because, like I said, I think, you know, big tech followed the trends of big media. They consolidated and makes it almost like we have no other choice but to engage with those spaces. Now, I will say, I think with the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, they're similarly facing a battle of trying to get a fifth commissioner on Gigi Sohn, who was nominated by Biden back in the fall last year. And her nomination process has gotten stalled again because there's a very concerted agenda on the right to prevent those nominations from going through. One of the unique roles that the FCC has now is in administering this money that was passed as part of this infrastructure bill, which has like $60 billion that's going towards broadband deployment, but also digital equity issues, teaching people digital literacy skills at the local level. There's a lot of money that can potentially reshape the internet ecosystem and disrupt another place where we're seeing market concentration, big internet service providers. And one of the opportunities, and this is especially true in California, is the state is going to get involved with all this money to build out fiber to communities that don't have it in California, to build that middle mile infrastructure. And then the last mile connection, meaning, which is typically the role that your internet service provider plays, you know, Comcast, that can be, there are many different options for that. You know, there are going to be opportunities for people to build their own, essentially become their own internet service providers in their communities through nonprofit organizations or through community-based organizations that can become that sort of provider for people in their community. And that's another place, going back to my original point, of finding spaces where we can govern the ability to own and be our own internet service providers is going to be a key component to this future internet that we really need to be building towards, where we can control those platforms, we can control the way that people connect online, because we can govern, you know, what rules apply and what don't. We can apply privacy provisions, we can apply principles of net neutrality, and we can ensure that, you know, folks are getting to your website in one click and not, you know, multiple clicks. And I think there's a real opportunity for that in the next few years for those efforts to really foment. And there's a lot of really interesting projects, you know, taking root in California now of people who are interested in playing that role.
Steve Renderis, as we're wrapping up, you mentioned the right having an agenda, but is it just the right? Because a lot of this could have been avoided early on. You know, Obama dragged his feet when he was in office, and he put people that were actually, we actually had to battle them around that neutrality. You know, I mean, they eventually went on the side of us, but that was wasted resources and a lot of cajoling and a lot of interest. Like, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but maybe Hollywood could benefit from having, you know, net neutrality protections gone. That's a big interest group, or maybe politicians. I remember, you know, a conversation with Jesse Jackson around that fight, and he was basically like, look, you know, if you ever need anything, you know, to get out, just hit me up, you know, meaning that he was playing broker, like, I'm gonna have access, so you can go through my site. You know, which is like, nah, why do I need to go to your site? I was on the internet before you were. You know what I'm saying? I mean, literally, but there were people in the Democratic side of things that were trying to play king and queen maker, where they could be proverbial middle people or institutions to kind of gatekeep and get messages out, you know, and not be subjected to the types of limitations we are subjected to.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, I think there's a real challenge in those in the Democratic Party, or at least a failure to see how the appealing to companies and being very, very cozy with them has made them susceptible to the kind of populism that is fueling, you know, the MAGA crowd. It's easy to call people like, you know, Democrats like Nancy Pelosi out of touch and in the pockets of corporations. And that's a very appealing message that mobilizes people to the right. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are other interests certainly at play. And I think Democrats have certainly have a track record of being pretty spineless when it comes to really exercising governance in towards, you know, towards the interest of the people that elected them. And I think part of the conversation then comes back to the electorate for us who are in more progressive spaces. How do we want to wield our influence, and how can we wrestle that away from this more kind of centrist model of Democrats that has been entrenched in power for a really long time. I mean, the two nomination process I spoke of that have gotten stalled, they're largely stalled right now because you don't have Democrats in leadership, especially on the Senate side, that are willing to ensure that that they have all the votes they need to get those two people through. And that's a real shame. You know, that's Chuck Schumer's job, you know, as a Senate majority leader. And he's not exercising his power in that way.
He doesn't want to. That's my point. Because, you know, there are people in his ear saying, you know, Chuck, why don't we position our people on the left to basically play the role that these social media outlets are. You know, let them go through us and we can make sure that their message, you know, gets to everybody in one click. That's the Jesse Jackson conversation.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And which was incredible when we had this, and you know, and it's incredible that, you know, down the line we're still having this conversation, or at least people trying to angle themselves to do that.
And at the end of the day, they're not seeing us as us on, and I mean us as more on the left or progressive fringes of politics. They're not seeing us as a viable block of people that need to be mobilized for support.
But this comes back to my initial thing, Steve. Why not just start our own? You know, people that have these organizations like Center for Media Justice, start the process. And, you know, I mean, I know you don't have tech people there, but you bring in those tech people and say, we're going to have this site. We're going to build these things up, you know, so that what we really need can actually be executed and serve as a model. Because it seems like if Elon Musk is not going to do it, Zuckerberg's definitely not going to do it. You know, and we have people in Congress that, you know, they want to be the head person in charge. They want to be a gatekeeper versus be a leveler of democracy, you know. Yeah. So.
No, I hear that. And I think for me, I guess what I think about is that we do need different digital spaces for discourse. And I think that part of what we need, or part of the solution moving forward, is more niche spaces that allow for us to have very specific conversations, you know, and especially in this era of mis and disinformation, what we need is better local information ecosystems, because we don't have a media system right now that adequately challenges any of that. And in many cases, you know, in parts of the country, like, you know, in Stockton, California, where, you know, Mayor Michael Tubbs got voted out because of a local disinformation campaign that was largely populated by a singular blog.
Right.
You know,
which again, which underscores the point.
Yeah.
What was the infrastructure that Tubbs and other progressives put in place to really democratize, and not just democratize, but also be attractive to an audience?
Right.
You know, that would be compelling. And we're not going to have time to get into it, but that leads into a whole other conversation, and I'll probably have it later this week with other folks. You know, we're cultural people.
Yeah.
You know, we use culture as a way to communicate, but I can't go on, you know, my website and just stream my own music, because there are companies that now own it. And they've been in the pockets of Democrats to say, Dave can't play that James Brown record, even though James Brown is iconic to our community and everybody would rally around his music. I can't put this picture, you know, this content that is suddenly owned, and it's not, you can't use it you can't use it in these spaces. But you can on social media platforms, at least they're paying people off or whatever, you know. So
right.
I can put a James Brown clip on my Twitter but I can't do it on my own site without, you know, having to pay because of copyright infringement, which is a whole other story. But we're limited that way. And I think that's another reason why these things became attractive.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's why I think there's the hyper-local, to me, like hyper-local information ecosystems is one of the things I'm interested in helping to foster and build. You know, there's good examples of this that are populating now in places like New Hampshire and Vermont, where they're experimenting with like very hyper-local social media networks. You know, where you can manage those kinds of very local conversations, public discourse that are heavily, you know, that have some clear set of values that are guiding the content on those platforms. And so they do actively take down a lot of content. They do ban accounts of people who are populating, you know, harmful speech, hate speech and whatnot, racism. So, you know, I think that is a part of the solution. I don't think there's going to be a singular platform that will emerge that will be that right. could be decentrally owned that could really provide a challenge to the scale of Twitter and even more
well,
so.
Well, Facebook. those things would have to have an attraction feature. Because we do have those local institutions. Mm-hmm. One of them is called Nextdoor, which is just a mini version of Elon Musk's hate speech, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's local, they do all that stuff, but it's just a continuation of, or it's a scaled down version of what we're fighting now.
Right.
So again, it comes down to, you know, do we have those institutions that we know, love, and trust
right.
that can even be up to scale with a platform like Nextdoor?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that if we built out that separate space, the alternative to Nextdoor, can we bring with us the social networks, the data that we've built on these other bigger platforms, you know, so that we can continue benefiting from them? And I think that's where I think both the innovation of new infrastructure and then compelling interoperability through legislation, that to me feels like at least a cocktail that's going to be necessary for us to mix in the future.
Real talk. Steve Renderos, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Let everybody give people the marching orders and let them know how they can get a hold of you.
Absolutely. You can check out Media Justice at mediajustice.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Media Justice or on Instagram at Media Justice. And then you can follow me on Twitter at Steven Renderos.
There you go. We're going to take a break here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
You can't fool all the people all of the time, but if you fool the right ones, then the rest will fall behind. Tell me who's got control of your mind, your worldview. Is it the news or the movie you taking your girl to? Know what I'm saying? Cause Uncle Sam got a plan. If you examine what they telling us, then you will understand what they planting in the seeds of the next generation. Feeding our children miseducation. No one knows if there's UFOs or any life on Mars, or what they doing when they up in the stars. Because I don't believe a word of what the president said. He filling our head with lies, got us hypnotized when he be speaking in cold words about crime and poverty, drugs, welfare, prisons, guns, and robbery. It really means us. There's no excuse for the slander, but what's good for the goose is still good for the gander, see?
I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. Computer chip in my arm. I don't wanna die by a nuclear bomb. I said we all rush the Pentagon. Pull out guns and grab the intercom. My first words would be, I believe man made God out of ignorance and fear. If God made man, then why the hell would he put us here? I thought he's supposed to be the all-loving, the same God who let Hitler put the Jews in the ovens. We don't fall for the regulars. They try to feed us all this happiness. Leadership, flipping position. They turn politician and shut the hell up and follow tradition. Boy, your TV screen is telling lies to your vision. Every channel got some brainwashed cops. The watch running up in cribs claiming that they earn shots. It's a plot. But Buster, can you tell me who's greedier? Big corporations, the pigs or the media? Sign of the times, terrorism on the rise. Commercial airplanes falling out the skies like flies. Make me wonder what secrets went down with Ron Brown, who burned the churches to the ground with no evidence found. It's not coincidence. It's been too many steady incidents. It could have been the Klan who put that bomb at the Olympics, but it probably was the FBI. Deep at the core, cause if they make us all panic, they can start martial law.
I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. They killed Huey because they knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is propaganda. I don't believe Bob Marley died from cancer. 31 years ago, I would have been a panther. You killed Huey because you knew he had the answer. The views that you see in the news is motherfucking propaganda. Thank you.
is KBOO Portland.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 39th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Gathering of the Guilds on Friday, May 6th through Sunday, May 8th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. The Ceramic Showcase features gallery exhibits, artist booths, and clay.